Hello, everyone. Welcome to our monthly seminar on death, the reincarnation, and afterlife. My name is Ashkan Bahrani. I'm the project coordinator at Monash University in Metempsychosis Project, and it's a wonderful pleasure for me to have Professor Mikael Burley with us as the speaker for this month of our seminars. Dr. Mikael Burley is an associate professor of religion and philosophy at the University of Leeds in the United Kingdom. His areas of expertise are philosophy of religion, religious ethics, and South Asian religious and philosophical traditions, specifically Buddhism and Hinduism. He has a PhD in theology and religious studies from the University of Bristol, and a second PhD in philosophy from the University of Leeds, where he has spent the last 2 decades researching and teaching. He is a very prolific author who has penned multiple monographs on comparative religion, the philosophy of religion, and ethics. Among them, I can mention classical Samkhya and Yoga, and Indian Metaphysics of Experience, published by Routledge in London in 2007 and 2012. Contemplating Religious Forms of Life, Wittgenstein and D.Z. Phillips, published by Continuum in 2012. A Radical Pluralist Philosophy of Religion, Cross-Cultural, Multi-Religious, Interdisciplinary, published by Bloomsbury in 2020. And of course, Rebirth and the Stream of Life, A Philosophical Study of Reincarnation, Karma, and Ethics, which is the most relevant of his monographs to today's talk. It was published by Bloomsbury in 2016. Today, Mick will discuss a very timely issue in the intersection of religion and ethics. The title of his talk is Making Sense of Genocide? Question mark. Further reflections on retributive karma and the problem of blaming the victim. This is going to be a 30-minute talk, followed by 20 to 25 minutes of Q&A. So without further ado, over to you, Mick. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much indeed, Ashkan, for that generous introduction and for the invitation. And thanks to everybody for coming along. My sound, my audio is okay. Can you just give me a thumbs up, maybe, Ashkan? Yeah. Great. So I have prepared some slides. So I'm going to see whether I can share them. So yes, as Ashkan said, the title of my talk is Making Sense of Genocide: Further Reflections on Retributive Karma and the Problem of Blaming the Victim. And to introduce this theme, the theme of karma and the problem of blaming the victim, I'll begin with three illustrative quotations. So the first is from an essay by Weipan Kunkau, who's a Thai author. From an article entitled Buddhism and Domestic Violence. And on the slide, I've got the last part of the quotation. I'm going to read out the full quotation. So I'll get to the bit that's on the slide shortly. But referring to a friend of hers in Thailand, Weipan Kunkau writes as follows. She says, "A close friend of mine had a 10-year marriage with a husband who was an alcoholic. With immense suffering, she went to see a monk, a Buddhist monk, and asked for spiritual guidance. The monk said to her, 'Be patient and keep making more merit, punya. so that one day the accumulated merit will help improve your life. That same monk gave similar advice to her friend, whose husband was having an affair with another woman. The monk told her friend, and this is the bit of the quotation that's on the slide, "There is nothing you can do about it. Keep being nice to him. Do not ever challenge his behavior, because you have done bad karma to him in your previous life." So I'm not going to comment on these initially. I'm just introducing the theme. I've got a second quotation here. This is from the Tibetan monk and scholar Geshe Sopa, speaking to the dean of Hebrew Union College in Jerusalem in May 2000. And this quotation is as summarized by the author Sally King. Again, not the full quotation is on the slide, but most of it is. So just the first sentence is not. So here's the whole passage. The Tibetans were invaded by the Chinese and suffered greatly, losing their homes and many lives. Why did the Chinese attack Tibet? It was a karmic result. We believe that this is due to karma, our collective karma. Sometime in our past lives, we as a group did something terrible to the Chinese. Our suffering now at the hands of the Chinese is the result. And I have a third illustrative quotation here. So third, an excerpt from an interview carried out by the social anthropologist Caroline Bennett with a survivor of the Cambodian genocide named Shrey Pik. After Shrey Pik tells Bennett that under the Khmer Rouge, people were forced to die, Bennett asks Shrey Pik to explain. And Shrey Pik replies that, as on the slide, if they didn't have karma, they would not die. It must be that they committed bad deeds. That's why they were killed like this. It's not uncommon for commentators on the doctrine of retributive karma to read or hear passages such as these and to see in them a kind of victim-blaming mentality, even when the one who's attributing the responsibility is also the one undergoing the suffering. It's this notion of blaming the victim that I wish to explore in this paper, with particular reference to instances of genocide. So in this presentation, which will be a summary of some of the material I've been working with, I'll aim to do the following. First, to set up the issue more thoroughly, I'll revisit some ideas from a previous paper that I wrote slightly over a decade ago on the topic of retributive karma and the problem of blaming the victim. Second, I'll examine some examples of the concept of karma being invoked in the context of the Cambodian genocide, and we'll consider the idea that such invocations of the concept contribute to or are part of an attempt to make sense of apparent vicissitudes or contingencies of life and death. And then in some concluding remarks, I'll draw attention to the incommensurability that obtains between the conceptions of moral motivation and value associated with the doctrine of karma on the one hand, and with alternative sort of non-karmic perspectives on the other. So the piece of mine, the article of mine that was published in the International Journal for Philosophy of Religion back in 2013, was originally prompted by the debate or the public row that was provoked back in 1999 by an interview, well, in the UK, it may not have extended to Australia, I'm not sure, but it was provoked back in 1999 by an interview with the then England football manager, Glenn Hoddle, in the Times newspaper. In the published interview, Hoddle was quoted as espousing a view of karma, according to which, among other things, people with physical or cognitive impairments are, quote, little quotation from the interview, born like that for a reason. The karma is working from another lifetime. What you sow, you have to reap. And Hoddle was quoted at much greater length than that, but that's just a little snippet. There was a media storm that erupted around this interview in response to Hoddle's remarks, and it included comments from representatives of organisations of disabled people, decrying the remarks as insulting and, quote, medieval. And there's a couple of little passages on the slide there from Anne Ray. I noticed that her surname, these are from two items on BBC News websites, and it seems as though the BBC couldn't agree on the spelling of her surname. So she's, but she's, it's certainly the same person, a spokesperson for disabled people. And the end result for Glenn Hoddle was that he lost his job as the England football manager. Interestingly, there were some Hindus and Buddhists and other traditional believers in retributive karma who wondered what all the fuss was about. Arvind Sharma, for example, a Canadian scholar, wrote a defense of Hoddle in the magazine or newspaper called Hinduism Today, noting that, quote, Hoddle's comments should have attracted little attention. The gist of the defense offered by Sharma is that the belief that someone is disabled or otherwise disadvantaged in this life as a consequence of deeds performed in previous lives carries no implications for how they ought to be treated in the present life. It is not for us to say it is the result of your karma, Sharma writes. It is for us to ask, given his or her condition, what is my duty, my dharma? And by this, Sharma does not mean that the belief in retributive karma should be relinquished. On the contrary, he thinks there's nothing wrong with maintaining that disability, poverty, and all varieties of disadvantage are the negative fruits of karma. It's just that he thinks this is not where the emphasis should be when deciding how to behave in relation to disadvantaged people. Rather, as he says, one should reflect upon one's duty and indeed perform one's duty, as just as the character Arjuna is instructed to do on the battlefield of Kurukshetra in the classic Hindu text known as the Bhagavad Gita. Otherwise, if you blame the victim, by which Sharma seems to mean if you blame them and decline to help them, then you will be blamed rather than helped when you happen to be the victim. In my 2013 article, I made two main observations in response to the line of argument expressed by Sharma. First, I noted that the reasoning is prudential. Invoking the doctrine of karma in the way that Sharma does implies that one's motivation for acting benevolently rather than dismissively towards people who are in need of assistance is that doing so is likely to favour one's own circumstances in the long run. I noted a moral distinction that's being overlooked by Sharma. What he and other defenders of the moral legitimacy of the doctrine of retributive karma underplay is the moral relevance of regarding someone as in some sense responsible for their own predicament. In other words, even if one provides assistance to the one who's in need, doing so despite the fact that one regards them as responsible for their situation has a very different moral character from providing the assistance simply because they are in need. In making these observations, my purpose was not to attack the doctrine of karma, but merely to try to clarify where a certain area of disagreement is liable to persist, regardless of Sharma's insistence that the dutiful thing to do is to help those who are in need. Okay, so much for summarizing some aspects of that earlier discussion of mine. And I do say more in that earlier paper than I've summarized there, but that's something, you know, a couple of crucial things, I think, for the remainder of my paper. So One of the things I'm interested in is the variety of ways in which, or circumstances in which, some version of the doctrine of karma can be invoked, and the various meanings or purposes that invoking it might have. The especially striking and poignant contexts in which it has been invoked include those where what the believer in karma is seeking to account for is the mass killing of thousands or even millions of his or her fellow compatriots. Two of my examples at the outset of this paper exemplified such cases. There was Geshe Sopa reflecting upon Chinese interventions in Tibet and proposing that the suffering and displacement of the Tibetan people is a consequence of collective karma. And there was Caroline Bennett's interviewee, Shrey Pick, asserting that victims of the Khmer Rouge would not have died had it not been for their bad karma. For the remainder of this paper, I want to dwell on the example of survivors' responses to the Cambodian genocide, but I'll also return to Geshe Sopa's remarks towards the end. So as many of you will no doubt know, what has come to be widely referred to as the Cambodian genocide occurred under the Khmer Rouge regime, self-designated by that regime as Democratic Kampuchea, between 1975 and early 1979. As in most genocides, estimates of the number of dead vary considerably. But there's general agreement among scholars that somewhere between a quarter and a third of the Cambodian population was killed during this period, approximately either slightly under or possibly even more than 2 million people. Several researchers who studied the aftermath of the genocide have found that survivors routinely appeal to the concept of karma in their reflections, both upon their own survival and upon the deaths of others. One notable example occurs in an interview carried out by Alex Hinton, an anthropologist, with a Cambodian man named Chlat, whose brother's family were executed at the Phnom Bros extermination centre in 1977. The example is poignant, not least because Chlat's brother, Shruan, initially thought he and his family had evaded the threat of imprisonment and execution when Shruan's name was not called out by the Khmer Rouge officials who had come to their village. "I'm really lucky," Shruan had declared. "I must have done good deeds in the past to escape death, because those people," that is the people whose names had been called out, "are not going to a new place, they're going to be killed and discarded." The insinuation, in Shruan's words, as reported by Schlatt and translated by Hinton, is that the people whose names were called out must have done bad deeds in the past. The reference to luck, however, is noteworthy. It suggests that the idea of karma can function in a way very similar to that of luck. The Welsh philosopher of religion, D.Z. Phillips, compares in a few places invocations of luck to talk of thanking God. Just as someone might say that they thank their lucky stars that they were able to do something, such as helping the development of their child's character, so someone else might put it in terms of thanking God that they were able to do this. Either way, Phillips notes, these utterances are reactions to the fact that what is contingent has gone in a certain way, in a certain direction. Thanking one's good karma has something in common with these utterances. Those who affirm that they must have done good deeds in the past for their current good fortune to have come about might be imagined, had they been situated in other cultural circumstances, to have thanked God or their lucky stars for the same thing. There does remain a difference, however. On the face of it, I thank my good karma may resemble I thank my good luck or I thank God. But invoking karma in this way nonetheless implies that the good fortune is of one's own making. There remains a self-congratulatory insinuation rather than a pure recognition of contingencies beyond one's control. That's my suggestion. In the case of Shuan and his family, their fortunes were to change rapidly. Late in the evening, the knock came on the door. It turned out that his name had been on the list, after all. As recounted by Schlatt, the next day at first light, the Khmer Rouge loaded everyone on the trucks. My brother and his entire family were executed at the pagoda at the Hill of Men. A few days later, clothes were distributed to people in our village. They were the garments of the people who had been loaded into the trucks. I saw them give out my brother's clothes. Just as luck or one's lucky stars or the will of God operate in mysterious ways, so according to the doctrine of karma, one cannot know how events will unfold, because one cannot know unless one is a Buddha, all the ins and outs of one's past karma. Charles Hallisey and Anne Hansen, in an excellent article on Buddhist ethics, have called this the opacity of karma. Hence, the role that thanking one's good karma has in a life is always a precarious one, for it's always possible that one's fate could change in an instant, at which point one may be inclined to curse one's bad karma, or at least affirm that one must have done something bad to warrant one's predicament. Some commentators have characterized appeals to karma as a way of placing one's current situation, whether favorable or unfavorable, within a longer narrative, and thereby making a kind of sense of it. As Talin Gray remarks in his PhD thesis, karma is a narratological device by which people situate themselves in time, to see the past as past and not to dwell in it. And Caroline Bennett describes the doctrine of karma as a device that can explain mass rupture and chaos, and within which actions that seem incomprehensible and insurmountable can be made sense of and understood. It's questionable whether, in many instances, making sense and understanding actions and events that would otherwise remain incomprehensible is the most apt way of describing what's going on. Perhaps it is, but only if by making sense, the phrase making sense, we mean something like avoiding the sense of arbitrariness that might otherwise attach to the actions and events in question. Even so, the opacity of karma remains, and hence one can never know exactly why one is suffering now, or why, for example, one's loved ones have been brutally executed. In many cultures, survivors of mass atrocities in which many of their friends and relatives have died may cry out, either overtly or inwardly, why did I survive and not them? Similarly, many who suffer immense trauma in their lives may look up to heaven and ask, why me? Both utterances express a kind of exasperation at the apparent arbitrariness of life, exasperation at how things go. Appeals to karma can be a means of cutting off that sense of arbitrariness, a means of affirming that despite appearances, there must be a natural justice underlying the flow of events. We might even speculate that something like an instinctive desire for justice or compensation or retribution lies at the root of the very formation of the concept of retributive karma. It seems plausible, to me at least, that the doctrine has its source in such instinctive reactions to life's vicissitudes, and that the higher level intellectual explanations or claims about the inspired perception of the Buddha and so forth came later as post hoc validations of the doctrine. Substantiating any such speculations about the origins of the doctrine seems unlikely, yet merely acknowledging this as a possible source helps us to see how talk of karma can come so naturally and can penetrate so deeply in someone's life. One ethical consequence of the affirmation of natural justice is that one who has suffered injustice in this life may find the will to relinquish the urge to seek retribution or revenge, because it's believed that retribution will occur of its own accord, whether in this life or a future one. An example of this attitude is exhibited by another of Alex Hinton's interviewees, a Cambodian woman named Neri, who lost her parents and 7 siblings in the genocide, the Cambodian genocide. Neri knows who killed her father, and she sometimes sees him riding his motorbike around town. "When I see him," she reports, "I get angry, but I don't know what to do about it. In one part of my heart, I want revenge, but I have another thought out of laziness. I think to myself, don't take revenge upon that despicable one. Let him suffer from his karma. Do good, receive good. Do bad, receive bad. So if I don't do it, another person will." Neri is evidently very far from forgiving the man who killed her father. Forgiveness is not an obvious option for her. She despises him, yet feels it's unnecessary to seek revenge herself because he will inevitably receive his just deserts in due course. Whether this thought of karmic justice is bringing any peace to Neri's mind is hard to tell, but it does at least enable her to view the loss of her father and other family members within a larger framework. This is the narrativizing or narratological function of the doctrine to which Talyn Gray and Caroline Bennett referred in those earlier quotations. Notably, Neri makes no reference to her father's past karma or to the karma of her other family members who were executed. Neri speaks of her thought about karmic retribution as coming out of her own laziness, which seems a surprising way of putting it. And I have no Cambodian knowledge of the Cambodian language myself, and I don't have access to the original quotation either, so I'm not sure what's being translated as laziness, but it seems a curious term to use. I take it that what she means, or part of what she means, is that she cannot quite shake the thought that she really ought to be actively pursuing justice herself, perhaps even seeking revenge, and hence the thoughts that she can leave the realization of justice to the natural process of karmic consequences might be regarded as evincing a certain laziness on her part. Another part of her meaning, however, is no doubt that the thought of retributive justice comes easily, naturally, again, perhaps instinctively. Hence, although the doctrine of karma itself can remove some of the apparent arbitrariness of life's vicissitudes, the ways in which the doctrine is made use of by believers display a good deal of, if not arbitrariness, then at least flexibility or adaptability. Sometimes the emphasis is on accounting for one's own good fortune by affirming that one must have done good deeds in the past life. At other times, the emphasis is on attributing past bad deeds to those who have suffered atrocities in this life. And in still other instances, the emphasis is on the expectation that those who have committed heinous acts in this life will suffer for it in the future. The doctrine itself seems consistent, but its uses and emphases are various. Now, I think I've been speaking for approaching 30 minutes. So in moving towards some concluding remarks, I want to bring in the notion of incommensurability. In my 2013 article, to which I referred earlier, I contended that there's a radical divergence of values or moral perspectives between those who understand suffering and disadvantage to be a consequence of wrongdoing in previous lives, and those who do not understand suffering and disadvantage in these terms. This divergence makes it very difficult for believers in the law of karma to see the moral significance of perceiving someone as responsible for their own misfortune, to see that even if one assists those who are in need, assisting them in spite of their responsibility for their own condition is very different morally from assisting them merely because they are in need. Nothing in the discussions of Buddhist survivors of genocide to which I've referred leads me to change this conclusion. And I'm again tempted by the idea of a clash of worldviews or perspectives or systems of value in this context. Sally King, when describing the encounter between Geshe Sopa and representatives of Israeli and Palestinian organizations in Jerusalem in 2000, calls it the starkest example of incommensurability that I have ever witnessed. Interestingly, she says that Sopa and the other Buddhists who were present rejected the identity politics of victimhood, of identifying oneself and one's group with that victimhood. Buddhists are taught to consider what actions of their own contributed to their present situation. By contrast, the Buddhists perceived both the Israelis and Palestinians as unwilling even to admit to wrongs well known to have been committed by present actors. And sadly, as we know, that conflict persists. When it's the suffering of a collective we, such as we Tibetans, that's being reflected upon, then it's evident how the idea that we collectively must have done something to warrant our current treatment can help to deflect the feeling of victimhood. When, however, one is speaking of others, whether groups or individuals, as having necessarily done something in the past to warrant their present suffering, or even their mass slaughter, then, I want to say, the doctrine of karma takes on a very different moral tone. Invocations of the doctrine of karma can, then, be an effort to situate suffering and death within a longer narrative and thereby to see a sense in it that would otherwise be lacking. The doctrine can also, in certain instances, supply a vocabulary in which to express the very incomprehensibility with which suffering often presents us. And so too can talk of karma amount to an exercise in blaming victims for their own circumstances. From a contemplative philosophical perspective, it is, I think, possible to see the attractiveness of the doctrine while also recognizing that for many non-believers in karma, the doctrine carries unpalatable moral implications. And I shall end the paper there. Thank you very much for your attention.